tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Disasters have always been predicted, and so, of course, disasters never happen. There have always been doomsday prophets who said the end of the world is near, so, of course, the end of the world is never going to be near. There have always been those who talked of ecological and environmental disaster, of the killing of the oceans, the depletion of oxygen at its source, the destruction of the surface of the land, the inability of humankind to survive because of the depletion of its raw materials and natural resources. There have been those in the ecology kick of the late 60s and early 70s who began to say that perhaps mankind could not survive ecologically past about the turn of the next century or so. And there are very serious prognosticators bearing no remote resemblance to religion at every conceivable spectrum of the scientific scale who are still sounding such warnings. On the end of technology and its development, there are those who point to the search for alternate energy sources and therefore the proliferation of nuclear generating plants all around the world and the potential for spillage of deadly radioactive liquids which are skimmed off from those reactors as a result of this search for alternative energy sources, the depletion of the Earth's fossil fuels, and therefore the necessity to develop, and develop quickly, other methods to harness the energy that is available. We hear of solar energy and geothermal energy. Solar energy is, of course, hailed as the absolutely cleanest, most efficient, cheapest, etc., of all of these sources. But at the technology end of the doomsday prophets, and they're all scientists, not religionists, there are those who talk about the potential of nuclear blackmail, of nuclear hijackings involving nuclear vessels or shipments of nuclear wastes. They talk of nuclear spillages or leakages from the gigantic number of nuclear plants which will dot the landscape. 20-some, I believe, on the drawing boards at least, for development in the state of California alone. And eventually hundreds upon hundreds of them girdling the globe in nation after nation, harnessing nuclear energy for the creation of electrical power because we must continue to toy with all of our playthings. We cannot give up the so-called civilized 20th century world of our gadgets and our gimmicks to which we seem to be virtually enslaved. We must have more and more energy slaves. Hardly a week goes by when you are bombarded with advertisements of all types of additional little gadgets, usually electrically powered, which can do for you in only moments what it used to take minutes to do. Everything in the kitchen is electrical, and presumably one of these days the housewife will be riding on a cushion of air on a little disc of some kind, skating effortlessly about simply by pushing toggle switches and buttons, or maybe better yet, she will be sitting in a state of near enervated exhaustion in front of the television set while she pushes the buttons, and maybe a robot moves about the kitchen doing her chores for her. I see now they have a little gadget out where instead of putting the mug in the refrigerator overnight or so, or simply putting it in the freezing compartment, a little bit of moisture still on it, or maybe dry, letting it frost up for a nice beer in front of NFL Monday Night Football. Now, you can buy a little gadget in some of these stores where you press a button and instantly it frosts the glass. Of course, I guess another way you could do that is just take a CO2 bottle and frost your innards and pour the beer in there. It'd be about the same. No, don't do that. That would be deadly. But, you know, you stop to think about all the energy slaves. It was years ago that the United States citizen, the average housewife and husband in an electrically driven and powered home with air conditioning and heating and lights and double ovens, waste compactors and waste disposals, dishwashers, mixmasters, and maybe that's a brand name and I should just say various mixers, blenders for all different purposes, juicers, all different sizes, shapes, and for different purposes, grinders, scrapers, various sharpeners for your knives, which are electrically powered, and many of them battery-powered and the like. There are electric knives, as a matter of fact, so that you just take your hand and just kind of hold it gently over the meat. It's too much work to make a little sawing motion with the serrated edge. And then, of course, there are all the other electrical devices that go in kitchens, such as various little portable warming ovens and the like, the electric lights over the counter to keep the food warm, the automatic plate heaters. There must be literally hundreds of them. that you can buy. Now, because of our gigantic energy binge and our virtual unwillingness to go without all these energy slaves, and of course, Madison Avenue Advertising that tells us we should not, we continue then to befoul the surface of the earth, to virtually destroy the oceans, to destroy the land, to mine deep in the bowels of the earth and right on the surface of the earth for coal, all types of coal, from the softer to the very hard lignites and anthracite coal that is to be burned and to be made into coke to fuel some of the big Bessemer ovens for the steel mills. Gigantic, burgeoning clouds of smoke boil up above our multi-million megalopolises, sprawling over 100-some-odd miles of landscape in all directions, while millions of people get in and turn keys in the neighborhood of about an hour and a half in the morning on internal combustion engines with infernal so-called smog control devices on there, which just about double your fuel consumption. So you burn about twice as much fuel to go the same distance as you did before you had the smog device, and they claim you're burning twice as much fuel and polluting less. Now, I'm not quite sure that they know what they're talking about. I just know it doesn't seem to make sense to take away the performance of engines, to go about half as far on the same amount of fuel, or put another way, to burn twice as much fuel to go the same distance you used to go and still pollute less. But maybe they're doing that. And so every single day in the United States of America, we put up into the air more tonnage in smog than we produce in tonnage in steel. So at the ecological spectrum, there are those who say that we are in the midst of an ecological disaster. Now, the newest sensational news to come along is the pollution of the oceans, and recently, nations have been saying that unless something is done to clean up waste flowing into the Mediterranean Sea, it will become virtually dead, just like the threatened Great Lakes chain of the United States, where it will be a complete ecological disaster. Years and years ago, on the voyage of Ra II, you heard about the Egyptian papyrus boat, where Thor Heyerdahl was trying to prove the theory of the migration of some of the Middle Eastern peoples over in the Central and South American areas. He mentioned that he was never out of sight in that entire voyage of flotsam and jetsam of this modern, mechanized, highly industrialized age of ours. That he saw on the seascape in all directions at any given moment, oil slicks, orange peels, garbage of all types, plastic bags and paper wrappers, floating on the surface or just underneath it, a kind of a scudge or a sludge of the flotsam and jetsam and paraphernalia of a modern age, it seems to absolutely fill the surface of the sea. Now, it's not enough to talk about oil spills as being a sticky, black, gooey substance that befouls piers and boats and ensnares and entraps seabirds and fouls the beaches of the entirety of the oceans. I think anybody who has been to the ocean, who has been to the sea, who has been to the beach lately, or at any time in the last, say, decade or so, can remember that when you come in, you've got to sit down before you step on the carpet and get some kind of a sharp stick or some kind of an instrument and go to work scraping off the bottom of your feet, because you may as well have been walking around in a stockyard. I can remember having been in oceans of the world, from the Gulf Coast to the Mediterranean, to the Atlantic and Pacific, and in places around the world where when you walk in after being out on the beach, you've got, well, the bottoms of your feet are just black with a thick grease of this tar-like crude oil that befouls the beaches of the entirety of the earth. Now, Thor Heyerdahl, who is a noted voyager deploring the fatal polluting of our seas, asks, can humans survive on a planet with a dead ocean? Ecologists insist that much of the Earth's oxygen comes from the diatoms in the sea. They talk about the entirety of the food chain that basically begins in the seas, because the seas represent not only three-quarters for the recycling of the world's oxygen supply, but represent the basic makeup of the surface of the Earth. Most of what we call planet Earth is ocean. Most of it is made up of water. And now the ecologists are saying we're coming very close to the day when we are about to kill oceans. People don't realize that our planet has exceedingly restricted dimensions, that we live in a narrow ecosphere. Man, standing right in the middle of the ecosphere, can reach up and there is fruit within his reach, can reach down and there are the herbs and root crops and grains growing right at his feet, that the oxygen is best and most plentiful right at sea level. That's where the pressure and everything is so equal that man is most comfortable. The higher you go up in the mountains, the more difficult it is to breathe. The deeper you go, the higher the pressure upon you and so on, the more sultry and humid, depending upon where you're talking about. Whether it's in a mine, that'd be something else. Death Valley is another thing again. But man is in the middle not only of the ecosphere, but of the food chain. The food chain begins with tiny microscopic organisms, coming on up to strange animals that appear in shapes that are so bizarre that you can scarcely believe your eyes when you see a microscopic photograph, a photograph that is blown up many hundreds of times of what is called krill or plankton, which at once is the food supply for the tiniest of fishes, all the way from tiny little daces to the anchovies that are the basic food supply for the fish of the sea, to the great whales who eat krill or plankton. Now those plankton migrate every day up and down. They also float around the earth on ocean currents from place to place. And it is now becoming of great concern that the source of the very beginning of the food chain may be a question of survival. The ocean is, after all, just as landlocked as any lake is. And only when you understand that there is really no fundamental difference between the various bodies of water on the planet beyond the fact that the ocean is the largest of all of them and is kind of like a lake which has shores and boundaries, can you begin to realize that the ocean is not limitless. It is not limitless in its capacity to withstand the impact of the dumping of prodigious billions of cubic yards eventually through all the years and centuries of human waste. It cannot stand an assault that goes on in the rivers, bays, creeks, and estuaries of all of this world around the clock, 24 hours a day, of the dumping of the pollutants of powerfully toxic and poisonous chemicals which cannot be broken down perhaps for centuries, that build up in sludges on the ocean floors. Nor can it withstand the shock of many hundreds of square miles sometimes of the flotsam and jetsam of oil, of all types of gases and fuels, of plastics and things that assault the surface of the sea. Maybe even a generation or so ago, no one would have believed, when you walk out and look at the size of a lake like Lake Tahoe, let's say, a vast, beautiful emerald of a jewel set high in the mountains along the Nevada-California border, one of the largest freshwater lakes in the world, and perhaps the largest at its own elevation. Lake Titicaca, down in South America, some of the beautiful, jewel-like, emerald lakes of the world, to seriously suggest a generation or so ago that that lake could die would have made a person look like an absolute fool. You would have been like people running off to stare out of the sun in a cave, drinking orange juice, waiting for the coming of the Lord. But now, today, people are listening a little more seriously because they're being told that it is essential to understand the concept that the ocean is, in fact, a lake which can and will die unless something is done about it. And perhaps it'll take another generation for people to fully understand that, but there is a limit to all of our resources. There is a limit to what the soil and what the water layer, which is so thin on the surface of this earth, can take from the tremendous impact of modern technology. The ocean is at the receiving end, as well at the beginning of the food chain. It receives all the waste eventually of the entirety of the surface of the earth. Let's look at it from an ecological point of view. The ocean is the beginning of the food chain in that perhaps three-quarters of all the oxygen needed for man and plant alike comes from the surface of the sea. Plankton, millions upon millions of tons of plankton, of tiny marine life, supports the entire marine system of life. That's at the very beginning of the food chain. The little fish feed on so many tiny microscopic organisms called krill or plankton. Bigger fish on the little fish, and the great big fish that we eat, such as tuna and salmon and the like, on the larger fish, such as the herrings and the dace and the various smaller fish like anchovies and sardine. Anchovies are the primary food at that size, at least of a very few inches in the sea. A primary bait fish, as many people might call them. This is commonly known. We, man, then harvest only a tiny minuscule amount of the food that might be available in the sea. And yet today, virtual wars are about to be fought because of the dramatic depletion of that supply. Because of the tremendous strain on such things as the pattern of the migration of blue and yellowfin tuna, the migrational patterns of salmon and sea-run rainbow trout called steelhead when they return, what we have done in industries to befoul our streams that carry these fish out to the ocean and up which they migrate back to the same gravel bar where they were born. But the increased use of electricity has demanded more and more impoundment of those creeks and rivers. And so the huge dams, and oftentimes, even with a fish ladder, the fish are disrupted not only because of the tremendous harnessing of the waters that they originally could run up and down freely without impediment of one kind or another, but also because of the pollutants that are coming down those rivers. Now, some states have made very serious efforts to do something about it. You can take your hat off to the state of Oregon, and perhaps to some degree to the state of Washington, the Pacific Northwest, who have really been on a concerted effort to try to clean up some of their rivers. Where formerly there were no salmon runs clear on up of the Willamette River, now they're having again those salmon derbies like they did years and years ago. The salmon are beginning to be invited back up those streams because of an intensive effort and very rigid state laws that are striving to clean up the pollution in some of the rivers. But much of the rest of the world is doing virtually nothing about it, and as a matter of fact, it's still going downhill. So the entire food chain in the sea is being disrupted by the not only voracious devouring of some of the fish from some of the big fisheries nations, such as the Soviet Union and Japan, people virtually ready to go to war over dwindling national and international fisheries, the squabbles today over whether it's a 12, a 25-mile, or a 200-mile limit offshore, whether you're talking of Iceland, the United States, or Peru. We used to get so incensed at the Peruvians for confiscating, or, as we might have said, hijacking, our tuna fishing fleet out of San Diego, maybe justifiably at that time. But I said in this program way back when, many years ago, it would behoove the United States to take a good long look at that 200-mile limit. Maybe we'd better pay attention to what's happening offshore Alaska and offshore Washington, Oregon, and California at those gigantic Soviet trawlers up there and those gigantic fish processing ships that come from Japan that process everything, clear down to the bones and the scales, of gigantic catches of tuna and salmon, which should perhaps be coming into American fisheries, and you'll find the ships, usually, during the spawning run, within plain sight, right off some of the estuaries and rivers of some of the major spawning runs in the Alaskan rivers. So the Alaskan commercial fisheries, as well as sports fishermen, are screaming to the high heavens about these Russians and Japanese that are getting American fish, right as they're trying, frantically, to go back up and spawn to produce another crop. So man, in all of his nations, and from every point of view, whether in search of food or whether simply hooked on his energy slaves, continues to assault the seas of the world. Well, finally, some people are beginning to get a little bit excited about it. Recently, it was said that increasing oil spills in the ocean could produce ecological disaster. It could disrupt the recycling of three-quarters of the Earth's oxygen supply. And this was a warning from the nation's top environmental quality control policy officer, that is, I should say. His name is Chairman Russell Peterson of the Council of Environmental Quality, and he said there is no scientific proof available yet of the ultimate impact of oil spills on plankton, the ocean water's equivalent of grass that supports the entire marine life system. But he said there is no proof either that destruction of the vital marine food chain would not result. This, in his address before the 1975 Conference on Prevention and Control of Oil Pollution, about 600 industrialists and governmental administrators attended that conference and heard what he said. It was also sponsored by the American Petroleum Institute, by the Environmental Protection Agency, and in cooperation with the U.S. Coast Guard. He said, and I quote, "Until we know all we should know about the effects of oil pollution on marine ecosystems, I urge you not to relax your efforts to reduce the contamination of the seas by oil." In 10 years, he said, we may find that the oceans are vast enough and resilient enough to absorb all the damage we can inflict upon them. On the other hand, we may learn that the marine ecosystems of the world already may be tilted toward irreversible decline. Now, he said, by 10 years, we may know one way or the other. He isn't predicting which way it's going to go. He's saying we don't know all that we need to know. Those who seem to know more about the ocean, however, have a little different point of view. For example, the famous oceanographer Jacques Cousteau said recently there was real danger that the oceans of the world would be dead, and I quote his words, dead before another 50 years have passed, end quote. And he was addressing the delegates of 138 nations of the Law of the Sea Conference, which took place in Geneva. And he was talking about their oblivious inattention to the terrible danger to human survival, talking about that meeting that took place in Geneva in 1975, early in that year, and how the delegates, instead of getting down to the task at hand and really doing something about the polluting of the oceans, were instead vastly exaggerating the concept of various mineral resources and national and industrial interests were the highlight of the conference, because that was what they really were talking about. Narrow nationalism, individual national interests in raping the sea and the soil of its raw materials and resources instead of a fully international cooperative attempt to clean up the pollution in the ocean. He'd called the ocean capacity a vitality quotient. Those were his words. And how that vitality quotient, that is the ability to absorb the impact or the assault of technology, and at the same time to recuperate and to keep producing, he calls that the vitality quotient of the oceans. He says that's going down much faster than he himself had expected, an estimated 30% to 50% over the past 25 years. He said it's become a question of the survival of our children now rather than that of our grandchildren. Well, Thor Heyerdahl, who made the famous trips that many of you read about, perhaps wrote, I believe, the book Kon-Tiki, didn't he? And then also on the voyage of Ra, too, as he called it, is really concerned about the ocean being on the receiving end of all the Earth's pollution. The ocean, you see, is the ultimate box canyon. It is the ultimate dead end. It's the ultimate cul-de-sac. All the pollution of the earth finally ends up in the seas. A farmer way up in the midsection of the United States who goes out to spray toxic chemical pesticides or perhaps artificial fertilizers on his soil, phosphates or the like, causes eutrophication of some of the streams, explosive production of various oxygen-absorbing plant life, which kills fish. Or perhaps at the other end, there are deadly poisons finding their way into the subsurface, even into the wells of some smaller cities who are using septic systems that are overflowing with all the chemical detergents and the like from Mrs. Housewife's disposals and garbage disposals, as well as her washing machines and the like, that are dumping all the suds that such great copy for Madison Avenue advertisers as to how many suds you get out of this stuff. And then, of course, you don't think about the fact that a lot of that stuff is not biodegradable. Some new soaps are. You can get biodegradable soaps, but a lot of it isn't. It goes into the septic system. Instead of allowing the septic systems of many a subdivision around some suburban areas to then do away with the wastes by normal bacterial action, anaerobic bacteria or other type, the bacteria are killed by the poisons in some of these various chemicals. So the wastes are just there. The leaching lines gradually allow it to be absorbed into various soils, and if you have clay stones and shales and sandstones and the like, it's not very absorbent. So nearby rivers, streams, lakes, and the very subsurface waters clear down into the deep water wells are polluted. Eventually, through the various action of erosion and the wind and the rain and the snow and the runoff every single spring, and it can be dramatically illustrated by the fact of massive fish and small animal and bird kills when things like that happen, these poisons find their way into the rivulets, the creeks, the streams, and the rivers. Eventually, they end up in the colon of Mid-America, the Mississippi River, that's dangerous to even camp along by, or to water ski in, or to breathe the spray if somebody goes by you in a powerboat. Because it's so poisonous, they have found that even 1 to 100 parts at the confluence of some of the major rivers dumping into the Mississippi of clear water would still kill trout when introduced into that mixture. Can you imagine that? Taking trout out of a fresh mountain stream in Colorado and putting them into big vats and introducing one part per 100 of Mississippi River water killed the fish. Well, downstream, a lot of the major cities along the Mississippi and other smaller towns have experienced massive fish kills in past years, but that's only indicative of what happened upstream in one particular moment, perhaps a flood or something of some spill of some chemical upstream or some oils or some toxics of some type that found their way downstream. But what about the day-after-day dumping of the prodigious amount not only of natural pollutions, of the muds and silts and all that is held in various solution in fresh water dumping into the ocean, but also the additional chemicals added by man? It is seemingly an endless, bottomless pit to many people, the ocean. But oceanographers are trying to tell us, no, it's just like a lake. It has borders, it has limits. It cannot continue to withstand the assault of modern technology forever. You know, in Bible prophecy, way back in the book of Revelation, there is a statement about an angel that symbolically pours out a vial upon the sea. And the picture is given of a sea becoming as if it were the blood of dead men. And it says in verse 3 of Revelation 16, "And every living creature..." In the Greek, it should be translated creature. Every living thing, that's talking of great whales, dolphins, sharks, tuna, salmon, great fish and small fish, and all the way down to plankton, every living thing in the sea died. Now, I'm not saying let's rush off and wait for the destruction of the oceans, but I am saying that there are many, many areas where, whether you look in ecology, in proliferation of nuclear weapons as well as nuclear reactors, at the inability of nations to govern themselves as well as to get along with each other, that very strongly indicate we are living in the time portrayed in Matthew, the 24th chapter, called the time of the end. It's not a time for people to rush off and sit in a cave and wait for the coming of the Lord. But it is a time, as the Bible says, to lift up your heads when these things begin to happen. These things, meaning all the things Jesus prophesied in Matthew 24, of wars and rumors of wars, that's the time in which we live today, of increased drought and famine, food versus population problems of the globe as a whole, of disease epidemics here and there, malnutrition, the assault upon the ecology, environmental disasters of every type, are listed in the 24th chapter of the book of Matthew. If you want to read a booklet that really helps you understand exactly where we are right now, before a prophesied time of the end, then you need to write for this booklet, The Red Horse, on the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, entitled War. And while you're at it, request this booklet called The Modern Romans, that show how we are living, being hooked to our mechanical slaves in a time not unlike that of ancient Rome, completely oblivious to all the warning signs around us, reliving, as it were, a time just before a mighty empire fell. Shades of ancient Rome, you can see how we in the United States are living in the very same approach to life as did the Romans, thinking nothing can happen to us, we can go on forever and ever, there's going to be no real paying of the piper in the future. These booklets are free of charge, there is no price. The Modern Romans and the one entitled War. And you can also ask for the current number of The Plain Truth if you will dial the toll-free number. They're waiting to take your call right now for the free booklets and a magazine of Plain Truth if you will dial 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444. If you live in California, Alaska, or Hawaii, the number is 577-5225. The area code is 213. Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.